self-inspiration.
It's really a cool article that talks about Billy and his conversion and how he's playing right now professionally, but also how he's playing at Community of Hope. And it talked a little bit in this article, mentioned on page 11 right here. It has a picture of him with Aunt Mary, and that's pretty cool too. But it says here, sometimes he'll get home from a show at 3 a.m. and has to wake by 7. Coffee is the healant of the nation, Coakley said. Is it easy to get up? No. Is it a joy to get up? Yes. And I thought that was just such a cool quote, you know, because that is what it means, really, I think, to be part of the body of Christ, isn't it? To get together with believers, even if you're running on fumes, even if it's like a couple hours of sleep, it's just a joy to be with one another.
We'll see how it works.
And that's what Community of Hope is all about, really. It's about you and me being empowered by the Holy Spirit and functioning together as a body right here. Well, that's a little introduction also for our speaker this morning, because Chris Steinman is a guy, I think some of you know him, maybe some of you don't, but every Sunday in the worship folder, there's announcements about Bible studies and stuff, and there's a Bible study that meets in his house for, it's generally speaking, 20-somethings, college students. I was there last Sunday. It was just a great experience, just worshiping with these 15 people, and here there was it had a great speaker there that night, and it was just a fabulous time that we had last Sunday night. And so I just wanted to use that to introduce Chris, who is our speaker for this morning. So, Chris Stein.
Before I get started, I talked to Owen on the phone last night down in Mississippi, and he said to tell you all that everything down there is going very, very well so far. They spent the night halfway in the Smoky Mountains at some place down there that they got for free, and they did some cleanup yesterday, and they're going to be doing house cleanup over the next 3 or 4 days down there. He said he'd appreciate prayers from the whole congregation, but that they'd already seen a lot of fruit being born in the lives of the people that they were helping, and the people are just so joyful to have people coming, because I guess nobody wants to go help out this time of the year because they're afraid they're going to be hit by another hurricane. So there are no like relief organizations working down there besides them right now. So just a little update on Mississippi. Today we're in the third week of we're doing a summer series on the fruit of the Spirit that comes from Galatians 5:22. It says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Jim dealt with faithfulness a couple weeks ago, and Doug dealt with self-control. And the reason that we're spending the summer talking about these two verses right here is because these are attributes of God, joy and kindness and love. But when we think attributes of God, we usually think like all-powerful and all-knowing. But these are the attributes of God that we can actually become. We cannot become all-knowing. We cannot become all-powerful. But we can become joy, and we can become peace and patience and love. So we're spending our summer learning how we can become these and how we can live these each and every day. But something that's important to, there we go. Something that's important to know about the fruit of the Spirit is that fruit doesn't happen overnight. This is a watermelon plant from my backyard. And I've never had a garden before. In fact, I've always thought the gardening was really, really lame. This is no offense to anybody who has a garden. But my wife decided that she wanted a garden, which means that she wanted me to make a garden. So I made a garden, and we've got all kinds of stuff, and I have this watermelon plant, and it's been there for like 6 or 7 weeks now, and it hasn't changed. It's like this every day. It doesn't grow, it doesn't die, it doesn't get bigger, it doesn't make watermelon. It's like this every day. And it makes me so mad. Like, I go outside every day, and I'm like, the tomatoes are growing and the cucumbers are growing, but there's no watermelon. Like, there's no, like, flowers, there's no anything. And I water it, and I fertilize it, and it doesn't change, and it doesn't grow. But that's how the fruit of the Spirit is. Like, it's a process. Having a plant takes time. You have the plant, and then you get the buds, and eventually you get the fruit. But having the fruit of the Spirit is not our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal is not just to have love, but it's to actually become the fruit of the Spirit. We want to actually become love. We want to actually become joy. We want to become patience. And the word that we're looking at this week is joy. And I don't know what comes to your mind when you think of joy, but I think of the birth of a child. Families are very joyful with the birth of a child. My mom would be really joyful if I had a child. She tells me this every week. You've been married for 2 years now. It's about time to have a kid, isn't it? No, Mom. And what I think about joy over the last month or so is soccer. I don't know if anybody else watches soccer. We're in America, so it's possible that there's like five of us in this room who watch the World Cup. But soccer is the only sport where you don't actually have to pay attention when you're watching the game in order to know what's going on. Like, I watch soccer, and I've watched way too much. I won't share with you how much I've watched of the World Cup. When you're a teacher, you don't have anything to do in the summer, so let's just say that I've probably watched too much. And you could watch a whole soccer game, and there's like 10 seconds of action in the entire movie. Like, they pass in the game, they pass the ball up and down, and they kick it, and then all of a sudden, they're about to score, and the announcer gets real excited. He's like, and he passes it into the box! Goal! And they freak out, because something exciting happens once a game in soccer. Never more. If it's a really good game, it might happen two times. But they're so joyful because it never happens. It's like a big deal. When you score a basket in basketball, it happens a lot. When you score a goal in soccer, you're the man. Like, it's totally different. That's my initial thoughts when I get to joy. But from a biblical perspective, joy is very, very different. There's actually 23 different words in the Bible that are used for joy. So when we use the word joy, it's like a catch-all for a lot of different ideas that the Bible has. The best definition that I can give you is this, that this encompasses all the different types of joy that the Bible talks about, but this is what they all have in common. It's the prospect of possessing what one desires or the emotion of such. Joy is not just an emotion. It could be something that's inside of you that you're waiting for. It could be something that you have but you don't have yet, or it could be that you finally get it and now you have the emotion. Depending on the context, it could mean delight, it could mean contentment, or it could mean exuberance. Like, we think of exuberance as joy because it's like an outward thing. But joy could be an inward thing. It's hard to show contentment, but it's possible to have it. So joy is something you could have, but not always be showing. And it's important to know where we get our joy from. The Apostle Peter says this, though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the goal of your salvation, the goal of your faith, the salvation of your soul. Like, Peter says that our joy comes from knowing that we have salvation. What we desire is to be forgiven, to have a relationship with God. And since we have that, we now have joy. The cry of Christianity is that I can't do it on my own. The cry of Christianity is that I need somebody else to restore this relationship. And since Jesus did that, we now have this joy. It's like an intrinsic part of the Christian faith. I don't want to get ahead of myself here. God has joy as well, and I think that his joy and our joy sort of work together to have this fruit of the Spirit. Jesus tells this parable. He says this, suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep. Like, I read this passage, and I think that God's joy is us. What God desires is us. And in the Christian life, what we desire is that relationship with God. It's like a two-way street. And Hebrews says the same sort of thing about Jesus when he was here. It says, let's fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Like, Jesus came to earth because he knew that he was going to get what he wanted, which was us. He knew that he could restore this relationship. And that's where his joy comes from. And his joy and our joy are going to work together to have this fruit be born in our lives. I don't know if any of you have ever heard Christianity and thought really cynically about it, but I did for a long time. And I remember being 16, and I had grown up in the church. My dad's a pastor. I used to go to church like five times a week because we'd sit in the back and doodle while my dad was preaching. And I always heard, like, God did this because he loves everybody. And I don't know if anybody ever thought this themselves, but I always did. I always thought, well, God died for everybody because he loves everybody. But he wouldn't do it if it was just me. I don't know if anybody else has ever had that thought. Like, if you were the only person in the world, would Jesus still die? And I found my answer when I was about 17 in this passage from 2 Samuel. David is about to die, and he's giving like his last like big, I don't know, speech before he dies. And he says this, they confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me out into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. Like, God delighted in David personally. Like, God's love and God's joy isn't that all people come, which it is, but it's also a personal thing where God's joy is Ernie, and God's joy is Nate, and God's joy is me. Like, God's joy is seeing us in a relationship with him. And when God has that joy, because He has us, then our joy comes from the fact that we are getting the salvation of our souls, that somebody is taking care of what we can't take care of. The question then becomes, what does joy look like? If we already have it, because God's taking care of everything for us, what does it look like when we have it in our lives? And I think it's similar to when you have an actual fruit, if we can continue that analogy. When you have, if somehow my watermelon plant actually made a watermelon, what could I do with it? The first and foremost thing that I could do is eat it. This is what I really want to do. I want to have a watermelon so I can eat it. I don't want to buy it at the grocery store. I want to make it and eat it, just like this little girl is. If I had a fruit, I could eat it. Or I could take my watermelon and plant more. I could make money off of it if I was a farmer. Apparently, this is not my calling in life. Or if I was a really lowbrow, no-talented comedian, I could smash watermelons for a living. I don't know anything about this guy other than his name is Gallagher, and he smashes watermelons. I don't know if anybody else has ever seen him on late-night TV, but sometimes he'll be there, and I think his whole thing is he smashes watermelons. I don't even think that's funny, but somehow he made a career out of it. So there are three things that you could do if you had an actual watermelon, and I think that the book of 2 Samuel is going to show us how there's three things that joy does when we have it in our lives. If you could grab a Bible out of the chair, maybe in front of you, we're going to be in 2 Samuel 6. Somebody wants to turn there and tell me what page number it is. It's 428 in my Bible, but I don't think we're 478. We're going to be starting at verse 11. I just want to give you a little bit of background as to what's happening in the story before I start reading it. David is king over all of Israel now, and he wants to bring the Ark of the Covenant, like where God's presence was in the Old Testament. He wants to bring it to Jerusalem so that everybody can worship together in Jerusalem. So they start bringing it up, and they're carrying it, and they're singing, and they're worshiping, and you can't touch the Ark of the Covenant. The Old Testament says, don't touch it, you're going to die. And they're carrying it on, like, they've got these ox that are carrying it on a thing, and the ox stumbles, and it starts to fall off. And this guy, like, reaches up so that the Ark of the Covenant doesn't touch the ground, and he drops dead because he tried to stop the Ark from touching the ground. And it says that David was angry with God, so he didn't bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. And we're going to pick up there at verse 11. He leaves the ark at a place, at the house of a guy named Obed, and we'll see what happens. Starting with verse 11, the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now King David was told, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the ark of God. So David went down and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. This is totally fascinating to me because David's angry with God. One of his servants just died for trying to keep the ark from touching the ground, and David's angry. But then the ark of the covenant is at this guy Obed's house, and everything goes good for Obed. So David's like, God must want the ark to be in Jerusalem. This is what I want. I'm going to get what I want. So suddenly it says that David is filled with rejoicing. Because what he wants is he wants the ark to be in Jerusalem. He realizes he's going to get what he wants. So his attitude instantly changes. And what happens is they don't just bring the ark to Jerusalem. It says that they take the ark and they're carrying it. And every time they take 6 steps, they sacrifice 2 animals and then move on. I don't know if you can picture this in your mind, but how long would it take to move something a couple miles if every 6 steps you stop to sacrifice? It would take forever. I mean, even if you're going like a mile or two, that's like a day or two long process. But David's like, I don't care. We got to give thanks to God because his actions changed when his attitude changed. When we live a life of joy, our attitude changes and then our actions change as well. David's not just singing, he's sacrificing this time. And he's not just sacrificing, it also says that he dances. And this dancing is going to be a big deal because it's going to get him in a bad situation with his wife. He's married to a woman named Michal. She was Saul's daughter. And the next verse says that she wasn't so good with this. Verse 16, as the ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. So we have this problem where when we live a life of joy, when we have an attitude change and then our actions start to change, sometimes people don't like it. I think when we live a life of joy, it always changes our relationships, sometimes for the good and sometimes for the worse. I know this guy who I was really good friends with when I was in high school, and we stopped hanging out after high school because he became a drug dealer, and I didn't really want to hang out with him anymore because I didn't want to go to jail. And so we stopped hanging out, and his life got really, really bad. And then about a year and a half ago, he came to know the Lord. And he calls me up on the phone, and he's like, "Hey, Chris, meet me for ice cream. We got to talk." And I haven't talked to him in like 5 years. And I have no idea what's going on, and I'm afraid that I'm going to be like part of a drug sting or something like that. And so I go to have ice cream with him, and he tells me about how his life is completely different, about how he's been clean for 6 months, about how he found Jesus, and his life was totally different. And it was so exciting. And I was talking with a mutual friend of ours about this 2 weeks ago, and he was like, "Yeah, that guy is so weird now. I don't really like hanging out with him. I don't talk to him anymore." And I'm like, "Why?" And he's like, "Well, he used to, you know, be like depressed, and I was all right with that. But now that he's not depressed, I don't really want to hang out with him anymore." And I thought to myself, that's totally weird. But when we live the Christian lifestyle, it's going to be a turnoff to some people. Like if you read through the Apostle Paul, he says that Christians are a pleasing fragrance to God, but to people who aren't of God, we can be like a stink. Like they don't want to be around us. The book of John says this in chapter 1. It says that people are scared of the light. They like the darkness. So if people are in the darkness, they might not be all right with us living differently. And this has huge ramifications on his relationship. In verse 20, David talks with Michael about this when he comes home. Just a couple verses forward. "When David returned home to bless his household, Michael, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, 'How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would.' David said to Michael, 'It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor.' And Michael, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death." His relationship with his wife was fundamentally changed because she couldn't handle his joyful worship of God. And it wasn't just his relationship, like her whole life was changed because of this, because she couldn't bear any children. Women were like nothing if they didn't have children back in the Old Testament. So her life was totally changed, and his relationship was changed because of her. Because when we live the joyful lifestyle, our attitudes are always going to change. Our actions change because our attitude is different. And a change in actions leads to a change in our relationships. And I saw this happen for the better this year while I was working at Lutheran East. I not only teach, I decided to start a cross-country team this year. There are a couple reasons I decided to start a cross-country team. I like running. I think it's fun. I thought it'd be a cool way to get to know kids. And you get paid extra if you coach. So I thought to myself, this is good. Because cross-country is the easiest thing to coach. You're like, go run. Like, you coach football, you got to know about football. You know, coach, like, most sports you have to have, like, knowledge of. Running, go run 5 miles. I'll be here when you get back. Like, it's really, really tough. So I decided this was definitely the job for me. And I had 6 boys and 1 girl. This is my team this year after a meet. And the girl back in the back, she's short. I don't know if you can make her out too well, but her name is Brielle. And she showed up for the first day of practice. And she's like, "Mr. Steinman, I've never run before. I want to run cross country." I thought to myself, oh, this could not be good. But then I thought to myself, I get paid more if I have a boys and a girls team. Why don't you run? This sounds good. So she ran like the first day, and she ran for like 10 minutes, and then she died. And she's like, "Mr. Steinman, I can't do this. This is terrible." And in the 10 minutes that she ran, she only made it like a half mile. This is not good. This is really bad. Like the rest of my boys are running like 5 and 6 miles, and she can't make it 10 minutes. And we went through the first couple weeks of practice where she couldn't make it more than a mile or two at a time. And I'd spend all my time trying to make sure she wasn't like dead on the side of the road when I'm trying to like coach the boys at the same time. So I pulled her aside at the end of 2 weeks. And I'm like, "Brielle, I want you to go home this weekend. Maybe cross country is not the thing for you. Talk to your mom. Think about it. Let me know on Monday." So she comes back on Monday. And she's like, "Mr. Steinman." And I'm like, "Yeah, she's going to tell me she's not going to run anymore." And she's like, "I went home this weekend. I talked to my mom, like you said, and I prayed about it." Brielle was the only person on my team who was like an actual Christian. So it was actually really cool. She's like, "I prayed about it, and I need to run cross country." And I'm like, "You do?" And she's like, "Yes, because I want to be good at track. And I prayed about it. And if I'm going to be good at track, I have to realize cross country is going to make me good." So I'm like, "Okay, this is cool." And it was like, I can't explain to you the difference in my cross country season before that and after that. This is not one of those stories where somebody starts out bad and then all of a sudden they're great. Because Brielle was always bad. Like, she didn't get much better. She ran a race at Luther West. I think Mark and Jim were there. That literally, for 3 miles, she ran a 41-minute race. You can walk 3 miles. I'm pretty certain I could beat her if I was walking, maybe backwards. And then the next time we ran at Luther West, she came in at 24 minutes. And we were all like, whoa, she cut 17 minutes off. That's because she only ran half the race, and she skipped half of it. She came in, and she was so excited. She's like, Mr. Steinman, I beat my record by 15 minutes. And I'm like, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. But what happened is she'd run every day, and like I'd ride up to her on my bike because I don't really like to run with my kids very much because my boys are better than I am, so I don't run with them because I don't want them to know that I'm not that good. So I ride my bike. So I ride my bike up to her, and she's always talking while she's running, like mumbling. And she always looks like she's in pain. She runs like this. And I can't understand it. And she's talking to herself, so I'm like, Brielle, what are you doing? She's like, I'm praying. And I was like, huh. And so my boys asked her the same question, because sometimes we'd run a loop, like we were running this thing where they'd run up and down hills, like in a loop, and they'd pass her. And they'd be like, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm praying. And the boys were like, whoa. So they started coming to her before races, and they'd want her to pray with them. And like, she'd be running, and you could hear her like singing worship songs while she's running. And I thought, this is totally cool. She's totally being an encouragement to everybody else on the team. So I'm like, I'm going to start running at practice with Brielle. Because nobody will know I'm not that good if I run with Brielle because she runs so slow. And so I'd run with Brielle, which is more like speed walking. And we'd talk about our spiritual lives, and we would pray together, and we'd talk about her church and what was going on in her life. And it totally changed our entire team because her attitude changed, her actions changed, and then it changed her relationship with me and everybody else on our team. In fact, the kid who looks like he's about to die in the front of this picture is a Muslim. And he was totally blown away by the fact that she thought that God cared when she prayed while she was running. Because Muslims wouldn't be into that. You know what I mean? The idea that God would care about their running is sort of a nuance of their religion that they don't have. So he was like, you really think that God cares about your praying while you're running? And she's like, he does care. Why do you think I'm still running? He was totally intrigued by this, and it changed everything, because joy, when we live a joyful lifestyle, it changes our relationships. That being said, we don't always live the joyful life. I remember when I was in college, I went to college in Ann Arbor, and I met this Chinese girl. There's lots of Chinese people in Ann Arbor, because the Chinese government wants the citizens who are coming to America to study to go to a fine academic institution. So they end up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Not in Columbus, Ohio, but in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I'm sorry. And I remember talking to her, and we were talking about the difference between American Christianity and Chinese Christianity. And there's a whole lot of differences, the first one being that Christianity is illegal in China and you can't really go to church. And she said this thing to me that I thought was totally fascinating. She said, why are American Christians so unsatisfied? And I thought to myself that was so telling, because people who can't even worship freely are criticizing us because we look like we're not satisfied. And why does our fruit go bad sometimes? I mean, sometimes we don't live the joyful life, and why is that? And the first question I think we have to ask ourselves if we're not living joyfully is, what is it that we desire? Because if joy comes from obtaining what we desire, are we desiring the wrong things? I read this really fascinating essay in Harper's Magazine. I don't know if anybody else reads Harper's. But this guy named Bill McKibben was writing a critique of American Christianity, and he said this: when Americans hunger for selfless love and are fed only love of self, they will remain hungry, and too often hungry people just come back for more of the same. Like, we live in an America where we're taught that loving ourselves is more important than anything else. It's like we're children who have never learned to grow up. The other day I was running by my house, and I live by West 117th Street in Cleveland, and it's like a 5-lane road, and I was running up this hill, and about, I don't know, like 200 feet ahead of me, there was this mother with her infant daughter in a stroller who she was talking to and playing with. And then she had a boy who was maybe 5 or 6. And he had one of those big round balls that sometimes you see like Kmart in like the $1.99 bins. And he's bouncing it on the ground. And he's like 5 or 6 feet ahead of his mom. And he's turning around and he's like, Mom! And she's not paying him any attention because she's paying attention to the daughter in the stroller. And he's like, Mom! And he's screaming because he wants her attention. And she's not giving it to him. So he takes the ball over his head and he chucks it into this 5-lane road where it bounces off a couple of cars. And then his mom paid him attention. You know what I mean? Because it was about him. But I think that oftentimes we live our life like it's still all about us. Like when we're obsessed with making ourselves important. I think that, especially in America, this is true, generally speaking, that we are more important than the things going on around us. And we're taught by the media and by our culture that we are more important than anything else. This is a quote from earlier in the same article that I thought was kind of revealing. He says, "Love your neighbor as yourself. Although its rhetorical power has been dimmed by repetition, that is a radical notion, perhaps the most radical notion possible, especially since Jesus and all his teachings made it very clear who the neighbor you were supposed to love was. The poor, the sick, the naked, the hungry, the last shall be made first. Turn the other cheek. A rich person aiming for heaven is like a camel trying to walk through the eye of a needle." On and on and on. A call for nothing less than a radical, voluntary, and effective reordering of power relationships based on the principle of love. Like, the heart of living the Christian lifestyle is that loving everybody else is more important than loving ourselves. And when we get caught up in what we're told by our culture that loving ourselves is important, then we no longer are desiring what God desires. Because what God desires are his sheep. And he desires for the people who don't know him to know him. It's like when when Jesus was talking to the Apostle Peter after he rose from the dead, he said, "Take care of my sheep." He said, "Feed my lambs." That was more important than taking care of ourselves. And when we put our needs in front of the needs of the people around us, we're no longer desiring what God desires, and we can't live joyfully. The second problem I think that we have is we get happiness and joy mixed up. We think that joy and being happy are the same thing, when they're two very, very different fundamental ideas. A little comparison: happiness means to be favored by luck or fortune. Joy, I already mentioned, is the prospect of possessing what one desires or the emotion of such. Happiness comes from Old English. It comes from the word hap, which is the Old English term for luck. So it's a word that's based on this idea of luck. Like, happiness is you're feeling good because things are going well for you. Joy, on the other hand, comes from Latin, and then it was translated into French, and then it became an English word. Happiness, though, is an American ideal. I believe this wholeheartedly. Last week, we celebrated July 4th, and in the Declaration of Independence, I think there's a revealing idea that America is built on. Thomas Jefferson wrote that America was going to be a place based on the ideas of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is interesting because he's quoting an Enlightenment writer named John Locke, who actually wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Property. Thomas Jefferson didn't like that and changed it to The Pursuit of Happiness. But our society is all about being happy. I mean, if you read the newspaper, you watch TV, you see movies, everything is about making yourself feel better. Or at least that's how they tell us that we're supposed to live. Like, you don't feel good? Do drugs. I mean, you're depressed? Prozac. You know what I mean? Like, your marriage isn't good? End it. Go find another one. Like, it's all about you need to be happy all the time. If we're not feeling good, then we feel like our life is not good. But the Bible doesn't say that our lives are based in happiness. It says our lives are based in joy. Joy is a forgotten idea. If we can substitute the word contentment for joy sometimes in the Bible, contentment is much different from happiness. Because it's possible to be content even when things are going bad. Like Jesus says in the Bible, that we should expect our lives to not be good all the time. He says bad things are going to happen. That's part of Christianity. Bad things happen to me, bad things are going to happen to you. If they're going to treat the master one way, they're definitely going to treat his servants, you know what I mean, even worse. So we live in a world where if we're expecting happiness all the time, we're not going to be able to live in joy, because happiness is an emotion that comes or goes depending on our circumstances. When things are going good, we feel good. When things are going bad, we're not feeling good. It's like Owen talked about emotional roller coasters last week. That's what happiness is. But joy is not dependent on outside circumstances. It never is. It's like happiness is about what's happening to us, but joy is about remembering what's happening for us. Because we serve the God who was and is to come. And he already worked it out for us in the past. He says that he's working out our circumstances now for our good. And in the future, he says he's got something better planned for us. So joy is based in the idea that God is doing something for us that we can't see. And when we're focused on things going well for us that we can see, we're not focused on what we need to be focused on. The Bible talks about this idea that joy triumphs over happiness. This is a couple of verses I thought were really revealing. In Acts, the first believers after Jesus ascended to heaven, they were put in jail and then they were beat. And as soon as they get out of jail and after getting their beating, it says this: "The apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they have been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name." Like, they've just been put through hell. You know what I mean? They've been in jail. They were put on trial. That's what I'm thinking of. And they were beat, but they were still joyful, because they knew what they had, and they knew what they were going to get. But it doesn't say that they were happy. You know what I mean? Because that's just not a reality sometimes. But joy is. James talks about the same sort of idea. He's talking to people who are undergoing a lot of persecution, and he says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance." He says, you can be joyful even when things are going bad. My favorite verse about joy being better than happiness and joy triumphing over it is from the book of Ezra. I think that it's really, really interesting. The people of God were exiled, and they came back, and their temple where they worshiped God had been completely destroyed, and they decided they wanted to build a new temple. But there were some older people who remember what the great Temple of Solomon was like. So they're seeing the new temple being built, and it's just not as good as the old one. And Ezra writes this, "No one could distinguish the sound of the shouts of joy from the sound of weeping, because the people made so much noise, and the sound was heard far away." Like, joy and sorrow are two things that can happen simultaneously in our lives. Because we can be sad about something, we can be sorrowful, but we can also be content knowing that God is working something out for us as well. I remember seeing this in my life when I was 17. I came home from cross-country practice one day. This whole sermon's going to be about cross-country. And my grandfather, my dad's dad, as I came home, we got a call saying that he had brain cancer. And this was like a big deal, because if I had to make a list of my top three favorite people I've ever met in my life, my grandfather would be top three. And I was like, whoa, grandpa has brain cancer. So I went in my room and I'm praying. And I'm praying for 20 minutes, literally. And as soon as I'm done praying, we get another phone call. My grandfather died. He got diagnosed with brain cancer, and then he died 20 minutes later. It was instantaneous. And my dad was really tight with him, and it was a really big deal. I remember being whoa, this is terrible. You know what I mean? Totally full of sorrow. So we drove down there as a family to go to the funeral. And somehow I got chosen to be the one who was going to help my grandmother everywhere, because she can't get around so well. So it was my job to take her from place to place, all day long. And we got to the point where they were going to shut the casket for the last time. And it was me and her and just my grandfather in the room. And my grandmother is just losing it. And she's crying and crying and crying. And I'm sitting there, and I don't cry at anything other than sporting events. So I didn't exactly know what to do. I was very sad, but I was I don't know what to do. So I put my arm around my grandmother, and we just prayed for 10 or 15 minutes straight. And we're praying, thank you. You know what I mean? Thank you for his life. And because it was a good thing. He was a believer. And he was one of the examples that really pushed me to faith. But it was sad at the same time. And something happened. There was this peace, and my grandmother started crying. And we prayed together for this long time. And my relationship with my grandmother has been forever different. I talked to her on the phone every other day or so. And it's totally changed our relationship, because we had this joy that something better was happening even though my grandfather was gone. Because joy is possible even when there's sorrow. The last thing that I have is another quote that I read that I thought was really fascinating by a guy whom I don't really even like. It's by Bob Dylan. And this is, the quote is from 1991, this picture is from 2001, but Bob Dylan was turning 50 in 1991, which means that I guess he's 66 now. I told my dad that Bob Dylan was 66 the other day, and he's like, wow, that makes me feel so old. And I'm like, I don't get it. Maybe when Eddie Vedder is 66, I'll feel old. But they interviewed Bob Dylan this, when he was turning 50, they said, "Are you happy now that you are 50? I have so many questions just about this, who cares if Bob Dylan's happy? Does this matter? In the grand scheme of things, I guess nothing Bob Dylan says really matters. But are you happy now that you are 50? And there's a pause. In the interview it says pause. And then he responded by saying this, "Those are yuppie words, happiness and unhappiness. It's not happiness or unhappiness. It's blessed or unblessed." Because when we live our lives focused on being happy, we can't always focus on what's happening around us. Because God has a bigger picture than just us. And we are blessed all the time. Happy is a yuppie word. We can't focus on that. We need to focus on God's plan, and that God has worked it out, that he is working out, and that he has something better for us. That's why I think it's so powerful when we sing the worship song, "Blessed Be Your Name," because we sing that even when it's good, we bless God, and even when it's bad, we bless God, because joy isn't dependent on what's going on around us. And when we remember that, we can live the joyful lifestyle. If you could pray with me. Father God, I just thank you so much for what you have done, for the fact that you gave your son, that your sacrifice took care of everything for us. I just pray that every day that we would live the joyful lifestyle, and that our attitudes would be in line with you, and that then our actions and our relationships would change based on the principles of you and your love, and the fact that you have your joy in us. I just pray that when we get sidetracked, and we start to desire something other than you, and other than what you desire, that we would come back to you, that we would focus our eyes on what you have for us and what you are doing and what you want to do in the lives of the people around us, and that we wouldn't be caught up in ourselves or anything else, but that our eyes be totally on you and that joy would be a fruit that we bear.